2022, tout le monde, antenne, corps étrangers.
Somebody want to react directly after that nice presentation of Aisha. It's not really easy to react because it's very pissed. But Aisha, I can ask you first question. It's just a feeling. So I saw you formal piece of you, and perhaps you can talk about the way you reconstruct that kind of this. Because in fact, it's not only choosing images, it's also looking for other images, like the label of our films. So it seems to be, in a certain way, taking a matter and recreating storytelling with also existing matter and existing footage, not only producing images.
Well, I don't know how well you could see the images, but all the images, well, most of the images before the last one are images that I took of the shipwreck or approaching the shipwreck. And to me, understanding this event that's kind of unimaginable, the scale of its tragedy and the kind of history that it evokes, somehow had this counterpoint to this experience that I had. I don't quite know how to answer your question, but there's several versions of this. I wrote a text version of this for the Architectural Biennial in Venice, and it's a text. And then I'm making a film version with someone named Hamadine King for the Dakar Biennial. But it sort of felt like, I don't know, each form sort of produces its own kind of silences, I guess, or absences. And to me, that was extremely important to this. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, but in a way, but just to continue, I think it was to say that it sounds to me like kind of polyphonic storytelling. I think there is different languages of the matter. There is also your voice, there is another voice we call. There was images without voice, but with kind of presence.
Yes.
And there is that kind of spectral presence. And so there is a kind of conversation around that situation in a way.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about this idea of technology, right? Like, I guess it comes out of this idea of this retrograde futurism I was thinking about. And then thinking, I guess maybe this sort of recapitulates the conversation that we were having before the break about the sort of notion of culture and the limits of language to explain our relationship to the natural environment. So I was in Dakar when I started this work, and then I finished it when I was in Trinidad, actually. And one of the things that I was thinking about was just the kind of material presence of stories of the sea or cultures of the sea, and how much both sides of the Atlantic shared that. And to me, that is a kind of technique. That is a kind of way that, because this, the tragedy of the Atlantic is centuries old, and the people who sort of are on either side are products of that tragedy. And so I see that as another way of telling the story. I mean, literally, this is the first time I've done this in front of an audience, so it's a very instinctive combination of things, but I think rather than hyperbolize a very tragic story of this ghost ship, I wanted to create a counterpoint of another kind of knowledge that could somehow make sense of this.
Somebody wanted to say something?
Aren't we supposed to be in conversation? Is this the beginning of our conversation?
No, it's well, everybody wants it to be trying to include people in general. I just had one remark, or not one, I mean many, and I'm talking through them, but just one as a question, perhaps in two parts. So just if the first off, we'd be interested to hear you discuss a bit more about this, the kind of intersections of this this woman's voice who's reading out these different names. I don't know if it's clear for everybody, but you can explain that. And then the other question is sort of related in some ways. And it's really, I'm not asking this with an answer, it's a genuine question. And it's for other people to try and think about as well. But what does it mean to do this kind of what's the word? Superimposition. This layering of two perhaps quite different, like oceanic tragedies. So to try and read the present of a crisis of migrancy on the ocean, and to try and kind of associate that with history of slavery, which is, I mean, I don't know, I was just wondering if we don't miss what's specific to both things in trying to see their similarities. I said I don't have an answer, I just wondered, does it help or not help to do that?
Well, just to answer your first question, the voiceover is recorded by Mary Lynn Pereira. And I have to figure out a way how to credit voices in sort of lecture performance format. But it's meant to be very clear, so if it wasn't clear, there's a problem with how it was. No, but I mean, the audio should be clear, if that's what your question was. It should have been quite loud and clear. And then, well, like I said at the beginning, when I introduced the project, that Black Atlantis is precisely trying to read these two moments of history together, sort of following Walter Benjamin's idea of the dialectical image. So the idea is to create a juxtaposition of two moments and not try to explain them or try to explain the time period in between, and to understand what's generative about that. And each project takes that on in a different way. But what I find very striking about this story is precisely the drift of this boat along Atlantic currents, which were exactly the same currents that would have carried ships of the enslaved to the Americas. So I think that nascent, like in this instance, the connection isn't nascent, it's actually right there, right? I guess I might just say that I think that coming at things from different lenses produces different kind of affective or different kinds of knowledge. So I'd say the same thing about the voice. If you juxtapose two historical moments and it produces some kind of connection that people listening to it can intuitively make themselves, because I can't explain it necessarily in the same way, I would have the same instinct about the use of not only two different voices, but two different sort of languages, right? And I think there's something that's produced in the friction between, which is precisely the point. So if they blend into each other, then that's a problem, because actually it's meant to be two things, and then it's left to anyone listening to make sense of it as they may.
What kind of resonance do you think that brings to have that voice for example,
Well, like I said when I answered Olivier, it's precisely that this isn't another form of techne or another form of technology, right? And to sort of think about these things in counterpoint. But also to sort of complicate a story, right? Like instead of, you know, there's this kind of genre, right? Like there's films about Mediterranean migration, and I think certainly in this room, but also at large, we have a sense of what the terms of that discourse are. And I think to make something uncanny or to destabilize it and to make one think in a kind of in a counterpoint would be my intention around it. I mean, whether it's successful or not, I don't know, but that's the intention.
Thanks a lot for bringing to us this issue. I really appreciate the way you try to examine the history of Black Atlantic and then the way you put in a politics about some mythology around the sea, like it was so politic to hear Mamiwata, Mamablu. Mamiwata, and I think it's really interesting. I would like to ask this question. Did you work a little bit about all the mythologies around this figure, Mamiwata, La Sirene? Because in Haiti, I ask this question because in Haiti, I know that La Sirene is a kind of divinity, and Mamablu and so on.
Yeah, I mean, Mamiwata is such a massive figure. So, in a way, what I've learned about her is that every part of the world, every country almost has its own story about her. And so I think that the fact that they're all recognizable as iterations of Mamiwata, I think it's really interesting, and then also the differences. And so I know about some of the West African stories about how she's a kind of seductive figure who steals from people who are passing on ships, and there's a kind of story of seduction, and you know, like this fidelity, seduction, wealth, and then it varies elsewhere. And I think that, just to return to the same idea of technology, I think this the differences of these stories is a kind of technique, is a kind of way to make sense of the ocean. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I just have a small point. Thank you very much for this presentation. I found it compelling from start to finish. And I thought there was, what I found really compelling was that I think there's a difference between the corpse ship and the ghost ship. You know, I think what's at stake is the corpse ship, the ship as a corpse. Corpses in a ship, and how you detail the processes of preservation, destruction, fossilization, and petrification by salt, wind, and sun. I think all of that is really compelling, because it's distinct from the notion of ghost ship, which brings with it notions of spectrality and ontology. And I think in a way your work is this project. Demands a different mode of attention. I don't think ontology is necessarily at play and at stake in your project. Whereas I think these notions of salt, wind, and sun as these forces of horror, which go to work on these bodies and actively enter into forces of life and then become forces of death, and then continue to act upon these bodies in this mode of preservation destruction. I think that's exactly what's compelling about the work, and I think that's a particular kind of horror, meteorological horror, which I think you've, by staying with it, I think you've really drawn that out. And that seems to me to put us in a quite different place from, the last decade of ontology, So it's just an observation.
No, thank you. That makes a lot of sense. I guess I noticed that that's how it was described in the media, but I agree with you, because it's a very... The story is a very materialist one, right? I was thinking that it's ghostly because it's an unnamed ship. We don't know where it comes from, but like you said, it kind of takes us in a different direction, which is not... I think the whole point of what I'm trying to do is very materialist, right? And to make tangible the weather. Just as like with Drexia or whatever, the underwater is materialized as a kind of environment. I'm thinking about the rain and the sun as actually part of the same ecology as the sea.
Absolutely, can I just a little point. I think that there is a spectral part, but finally that is also a matter with, I would call it, frequencies. All the voices that we hear, it makes me think about what Graham Thompson, Mr. Baglioni did with the Sample One and a boat crossing the ocean with the radio. There was a caster, and with his radio, he turned the frequency of the radio, trying to receive the voices of the dead of the oceans.
Sorry.
So,
Sorry?
Firstly, Sylvia Maglioni and Graham Thompson, the film called This Other One. Mm-hmm. And there is a greater character, a different character on that boat, which is a kind of ghost boat in a certain way. It's a huge, huge boat, in fact. And different characters are doing things in that boat, and one of them is a transmitter. And the transmitter, I think so, is transduced and transmits. Mm-hmm. And so he's playing with a radio on the boat and trying to find frequencies of the different voices of the ocean, of the history of the ocean. So it can be considered as not a spectral thing. We can decide that it's also a matter of the ocean, that frequencies.
Well, sound is as material as anything.
Exactly. Exactly in the sense that Rex used the idea of sound.
Yeah.
Is there anybody you want to say a comment?
Yeah, I
want
to join everyone in thanking you for this really wonderful work. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the currents that carried the first ship across the Atlantic.
The first ever ship?
The first story you tell, ship went all the way across the Atlantic.
Yes.
What can you tell us about those currents?
Well, essentially they're currents that lead, I don't know how to respond to that except that it's currents that literally abet the sailing of a ship from West Africa to Barbados. So essentially the ship ran out of fuel and then just drifted, and it literally just drifted to the coast of Barbados. That there was no navigation, people had already died by then. And so, and from what I understand, those are exactly the currents that that ships of the enslaved traveled on. So it just facilitated that journey. But that's a very basic answer, so I think you're probably asking something more.
Actually, it's a basic thing, because this actually loops back to the question Louis asked about connecting what you're writing about and showing us now with the slave trade then. And I was completely caught immediately with the first story that you depicted for that reason.
Right.
And I don't know, maybe lifting it up would make it a little more apparent. I know nobody wants to be obvious, but sometimes obvious is good. Somehow in the work to a phrase that showed that fact to be the case for those who don't know that fact.
I do say it, but maybe I just didn't say it slowly enough.
It's
possible. I made a couple of references to that. That's one of the undercurrents, what I call an undercurrent of horror of this journey, is that it recapitulates that historical moment by traveling the same distances and knowing that there's literally no steering involved in this process. So I bring it up a couple of times, but maybe more.
Okay, I missed it.
Oh, no,
my bad.
Okay.
Thank you.
Does somebody else want to say something? I like this. Okay, so back to the respondent.
I don't know if it was cancelled. So one other thing then would be interesting to think about, just for you to, again, I just ask these questions for you to elaborate on, doesn't it? So I have no predetermined answers behind that question. But then just thinking of this superposition then of these two time frames, perhaps, of, a crisis of migrancy on the ocean and then forced migration of slavery. And then just you said at the beginning of the introduction about the work in general with Black Atlantis being interested in trying to find a connection with questions to do with the Anthropocene. So I would be really interested to hear you talk a bit more about that, because perhaps then I do have an answer to my question. But no, but just to see then how those two things then, what relationship slavery has to the Anthropocene, and then how that might come round in the present to what relationship these new forms of forced migrancy have to the Anthropocene as well.
That's a big and good question. I don't know where to start. So the relationship between, you want me to first start with the, like, elaborate again the relationship between these two moments, or the relationship to the Anthropocene, these two moments to the Anthropocene? Is that your question?
Yeah, it's just, I mean, just how it comes into your work, how
you, well,
this, or you can focus more on the present now, for example.
No, that's fine. So I guess the project, I mean, I guess my background is in studies of the Black Atlantic. That's what I did my PhD on, and then after that, I had a kind of art practice and an activist practice of doing a lot of work with No One Is Illegal and working with illegalized migrants in Canada, and then when I moved to the UK. And it just felt like there was... It just seemed like that there was a kind of resonance between the two that could be read together, and then I guess this may be for the benefit of a wider audience. I came across this band called Drexia, I guess Fodor and Angelia are going to talk about, and that actually created the project called Black Atlantis, which is to think about the materiality of the ocean as a kind of factor, right? And obviously, even with Lorenzo and Charles's work, Forensic Oceanography, there's just a thread of work that kind of thinks about the materiality of the environment. But what Drexia opened up for me, I don't want to say too much about Drexia because I feel like we're going to hear quite a bit about Drexia after I'm done. But they had this imaginary, basically through their liner notes, they retell the story of the jettison of the slave ship song, and they talk about how the enslaved adapted to living underwater and formed an Atlantis, a Black Atlantis, under a sea called Drexia. And to me, when I encountered that, that opened up the whole idea of what that environment might look like, because they're quite literal about what that environment looks like. So there's several, like I said, this is the fifth version of this project, but I have one that looks at hydrothermal vents, and other kind of monsters, monsters, racinated monsters that might live under the sea. Monsters meaning in it, kind of like in this way water spirits are monstrous, like powerful and also frightening. I also did one project on the plantation scene where I was living in Barbados and actually on the site of a former slave plantation and trying to think about issues in climate change. In relation to a farm whose property lines were still the same lines as when it was a plantation, an enslaved plantation. But the registers of time around that are completely incommensurable. Like, it's completely difficult to put these three things together. So a part of it is just staying with that trouble and staying with that inability to explain these divisions and thinking it through. So each, I guess the reason why this is in different chapters is because the comparison just opens up into so many different A, geographical areas, but B, forms of discourse, historical periods, that they're just what they are, a series of juxtapositions that I can't quite explain.
And then, I mean, just one last little thing, then also to think perhaps about, well, I mean, I guess what I was trying to get at was also thinking about perhaps an interesting kind of correlation, in, you know, and that maybe it's not such a juxtaposition that can't be explained, that in fact we can see a correlation and a sort of cyclical process of imagining, for example, the, you know, 1492, let's take as a date off the pick of my head, just coming up like that, you know, which is the discovery of Christopher Columbus by the indigenous of the Caribbean when they first discovered him. It's, you know, largely argued as the beginning of sort of mass exportation and importation of plants and seeds and also bodies, different species into that part of the world, which is, you know, really the kind of large part of the process of changing the Earth's surface that we're currently, you know, like conceptualized with words like the Anthropocene. So how that might be understood as some beginning, if we want to look for a beginning. So then, you know, we have these ideas, people have been speaking around the plantation scene, which you mentioned earlier, for example. And then how that has, in some respects, come round full circle, and how now the current kind of climate conditions and that we're facing are actually also what are producing mass migration because of the absolute destruction of farming lands, for example, in kind of arid areas. So, which are then causing, you know, lack of work, lack of labour, which then causes migration. So, I mean, in that sense, I suppose maybe I was trying to make that even clearer, even though you're making it in the work. But maybe it's not just the juxtaposition that can be unexplained. Perhaps by reading it as those forms of cycles, can perhaps give us an interesting, you know, way to understand the present.
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And I think it's really interesting that you say that because, and I think it's interesting to also mobilize nature. I don't, like, the weather's a character in this, but in my piece on the plantation of scenes, which is largely based in Barbados and Trinidad, but one thing that's kind of quite significant in Barbados is that it's, what's it like? There's only 12 inches of soil. It's rock underneath the soil. There's only 12 inches of soil, and there's only two plant species, plant genres, whatever, that are indigenous to Barbados. Everything else was either brought by colonialists or brought by birds flying from other islands or flown, just carried on by wind currents over the sea. So I think the kind of complicity of those forces, whether it's colonial and nature, sort of producing this environment is really interesting. And the other thing I can think of in relation to that is how Barbados is very close to the Sargasso Sea. And one of the things that's really unique about the Sargasso Sea is that it's not surrounded by any coastline. It's a sea in the middle of the ocean, right? But what kind of keeps it its own distinct body of water is that it is characterized by centrifugal forces, so it's a kind of whirlpool, right? And in that whirlpool, what's sort of carried along its periphery, you might notice, is seaweed. It's this massive amount of seaweed. And the summer before I went to Barbados, the force of the spin had reduced, and basically, like, feet high of seaweed was getting deposited on the Bajan soil, on the Bajan coast, sorry, on the beaches. So suddenly, that, I mean, that's kind of, and that's due to, like, the heating up of the water and all kinds of, like, environmental forces. So I think thinking about these birds and the wind carrying the seeds along with the swirling, I mean, it is not, like you said, maybe it is more literal than one can imagine, but there's also gas.
Thank you so much, Aisha.